Great. So,
as William said, my name is Yi Qiang, and my project is distributed computing with Sage. So let's jump right into it. What is distributed computing? Distributed computing is a way of processing information that is decentralized in parallel. And it was really made possible and popularized by the internet because computers all over the world could talk to each other now via one common language, and that was HTTP. It's similar to clustering, if any of you are familiar with that, in that you harness the computing power of many, many computers to do a single task. The greatest benefit, in my opinion, about distributed computing is that it's heterogeneous, meaning that when you collect the computing power of multiple computers, it doesn't matter what kind of hardware they're running, it doesn't matter what operating system they're running, and it doesn't matter where they're geographically located. There's only two things you need to participate in distributed computing, and that is the program that you're going to run to process input and spit back some output, and internet connection. So it's very, very accessible to people. And also, the other good thing about distributed computing is that there's a lot of computer power that we can harness, because as you're listening to me, your computer back in your office is probably not doing much, and it could be helping solve interesting mathematical problems. So there's a lot of untapped power that we can harness. All right, so to give you a general idea of where distributed computing has been used, I think the biggest and one of the first projects that really showed to the world how powerful it is was distributed.net, and they tried to break various encryption standards. So they finished RC 564, which was a 64-bit key, in 2002, and I think it took them about 2 years to search through the key space. And I don't think they searched through all of it, but I think it took them, they searched more than half of it before they found the answer. And they're working on RC 572 now. So that project really showed to the world how much power you can get by using.
Do you have any sense for how much resources they had? How many people participated?
I don't know, but I think those stats are available online, and I think there were hundreds and thousands of participants.
Wow.
And they just had, you know, people donated their computer power, and they ran as a screensaver or in the background while they were doing anything. And yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of computing power to brute force through those keys, and they did it. So that project really showed the world how powerful it can be. And then since then, there have been many others. For example, SETI at Home, which I'm sure all of you guys have heard about. It's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They haven't been very successful at finding anything, but it's interesting nonetheless, and many people participate in that. A more concrete project is Folding at Home, and basically it uses people's home computers to try and understand why proteins misfold. And I'm not a biologist, but apparently it has very great implications in biology if you could understand why proteins misfolded. So those are some of the big names in distributed computing, and there are many more. If you check out the list on Wikipedia for a decent-sized list, I think I saw maybe 30, 35 projects that are using distributed computing now, and they're doing, there's one called Fighting AIDS at Home, where you test AIDS drugs, where you simulate what the effect that AIDS drugs would have. And then there's one called Einstein at Home, which tests some Einstein theory. So people are really using this for all sorts of problems, and it's very popular. And then there is GIMS, and that is probably the most applicable one, or the most mathematically related distributed computing project. As you know, it searches for Mercian primes, which are the form 2 to the n minus 1. And they, December 15th, so just last year, they found the 43rd Mercian prime, and it's some ridiculously large number. And again, this really shows you how much computing power there is for free, because all these people participate on a volunteer basis. And Will and I talked at length about how powerful this is, but how it's not really that interesting to serious mathematicians. There could be better, the time doing this could be spent on something else that might perhaps be more interesting for some people.
Maybe flexible.
Does it excite you to hear about it?
No, it doesn't.
Serious mathematician, not excited.
I'm not excited about the 43rd percent. Are you?
No.
Okay, so now that we have a good idea of what distributed computing is, let's talk about how we can do it with Sage. The way I envision this program is based on a very simple client-server model. It's something you learn in any CSE course. It's very simple, and I wanted to implement it using simple but robust Python frameworks. So the three things that we need to accomplish this goal is something called XML-RPC, which is a way for a client to talk to a server and vice versa. BSDDB, which is just a database. It stands for Berkeley Standard Distribution Database. It's a very simple, you can only do lookups by key. In the future, we might be able to get MySQL if we want to be more fancy. And a thread-safe queue, because the implementation will be multi-threaded to be able to handle concurrent connections. So just these three simple things are almost enough to do this. And Python's tagline is, comes with batteries included. So it comes with all of these things and its standard distribution. For the XML RPC server, we have something called the Simple XML RPC server. It provides a wrapper around BSDDB, and it provides a thread-safe queue. Oh, and I should mention that XML RPC stands for Extensible Markup Language Remote Procedure Call. Basically, it's a way to pass data back and forth between client and server, and it wraps it in an XML file. Oh, and please feel free to interrupt with any questions you might have.
So, you said you already did something like this in the biology department or something?
Oh, yeah. So at my current job, I work for the biochemistry department, and we write a program that refines protein structures that have been done by X-ray diffraction. And we implemented something like this using simple XML RPC server. And I'm working currently on right now to be able to harness the computing power of the desktops at my job to process these things, because it takes up to 80 hours of computing time to do one thing. So it takes a long time for people to get
it. That's also in Python, so.
Yeah, that's also in Python, so.
So hopefully it won't be too hard to do something. I mean, you won't have to learn too much.
Oh, no. Like, I spent maybe 10 hours on this already, and I'm at about 450 lines of code. And it's amazing, 450 lines of code. I have a working server, and right now I can send it primary jobs to test whether a number is prime or not, just like the GIMPs, and it'll work. But there's a lot more logic to be added. But yeah, I already got a good start on this. So this is kind of, it doesn't show up very good, but the way it works is that you have clients, and again, they're very heterogeneous. You can have PCs, Macs, some workstations, Spec Alphas, laptops, tablet PCs, whatever. As long as they run Python and Sage, they can participate. And they basically send XML RPC requests to the server, and it's very simple. It just looks like server.getNextJob. And the server will send it a job, and it will try and run Sage on that job, compress the result, and do server.submitJob. And all this happens over the internet, over HTTP. So it's very simple, it's very lightweight, there's not a lot of overhead. And yeah, so the server can send jobs in a job database, or it can take jobs and put it back in the job database and mark it as being completed, and then we can go back and pull out all the completed jobs and then do some processing it to generate statistics or what have you. So it's quite simple. It's a very simple model.
Can you easily send arbitrary data over XML RPC?
So XML RPC is actually, it's not...
What is it? Where does it come from?
It's just something that some people hacked up together to pass data back and forth. But it's not like an official protocol. And the way
is it used in any famous thing that I might know about?
Amazon's web services run on SOAP, which is just an extension of XML RPC. I can't think of a top of the head of anything that just only uses XML RPC. But SOAP is just basically more hacks thrown into XML RPC. So you can send arbitrary data because you can wrap it in a binary thing and then pass it back and forth. I think the protocol itself allows you to send back strings, booleans, and integers, but you can send anything by wrapping it as a binary.
How's that the simple XML RPC server different from the simple HTTP server?
I'll show you, but it actually just inherits it. Yeah, so there is some extra code, but it inherits it. I think, actually there's a good picture, they don't have one here, but I can show you later. Okay, so just to give you an idea of how simple it is to create an XML RPC server in Python, it only takes 3 lines of code. You import the module, and then you create a server object, and you can just do server.serveForever, and it will work and take requests until you explicitly kill it. Of course, this doesn't do much because we haven't registered any functions with it. So
does it have any defaults or like anything you can see at all?
No.
Really
no. Right now, I mean, if you try to send in any request, it'll say blah blah blah. This method is not available, or we don't support this method.
And how do you connect to it from Python? Do you have to import
as a client?
Yeah.
Okay. As a client, you import XML RPC lib, and you say server equals. XML RPC server at this address, at this port, and then you can just talk to it. That's only one line also.
Got it.
So it's very, very simple. So yeah, that's really quite powerful because try doing this in C. So let's talk about what problems are good for distributed computing, because although it is very powerful, it's not suitable for any problem. So for this to be really applicable, we need problems that are easily parallelized. That means that they can be split up into smaller chunks. And even more importantly is that the successful completion of one chunk does not depend on another.
Sorry, another question. So is XML RPC like totally obviously the canonical choice for what you're doing, or are there other competing possibilities for how you would connect and sort of give and get data? Or they're just so obviously the right thing to use. I'm just curious.
I don't know. It's just something that like I know that works. I suppose you could write it like just as a raw socket, but I mean there's a lot of more just like underlying code that you have to mess with. So for me, maybe someone knows about it better.
Well, this is very common XML RPC.
Right.
SOAP and REST would be the other.
Right. But SOAP, from what I understand, it's has more functionality, and so, but REST.
It's not fundamentally different.
Well, I don't know, but that's what I figured. It's like, or from what I've read, that SOAP is for some reason heavier. But basically, all we need is to be able to pass data back and forth, and XML RPC will do that. Okay, so where was I? Oh yeah, so. The failure of one.
So when you say so, if you have a remote ZODB server, a SOAP object database server, is it using
remote what?
ZODB. SOAP has something called the ZODB, the SOAP object database, and it can open up a server, and you can connect to it remotely and just use the database remotely. That's probably implemented using XML RPC. I don't know.
I mean,
is that what you're saying when you keep saying that SOAP uses it?
Not ZOP.
Because ZOP also has a.
Okay, that might be very confusing, but yeah, it's SOAP.
It may very well be using XML RPC.
I don't know, but yeah, so SOAP. Okay. It's very confusing to say. That's what it's saying. The failure of one task can't mean that everything else will fail also. And it's also important that there can be very much client-to-client communication, because that adds a whole other layer of complexity to the program. So it's not peer-to-peer. If clients do need to talk to each other, the way I see it is that they can leave messages on the server, and then they can communicate that way. But there's overhead for that. And then the other big issue is that we need to be able to verify answers. Because for various reasons, faulty hardware, software, will cause people to send incorrect answers. And we need to protect ourselves against that. And there's various mechanisms to do that. Oh, and so for example, one way that people can generate faulty answers is, for example, you have this guy who likes to overclock his CPU. So he takes this Intel Pentium 4 and overclocks it to 6 gigahertz. Well, when you do a lot of floating point calculations, something might get messed up. So a good way to protect yourself against that is by sending the same job to multiple clients and then comparing the output. And they don't match up, then there's something wrong. And you can redo it again, flag it, have someone look at it. So yeah, we need to make sure that we can verify the answers. Otherwise, it's completely useless. Okay, so there are a lot of things that remain to be done. And one of them is to figure out more problems that can be solved using this. I think Lauren has mentioned that extending from MS database would be a very good application for this. And
on your RE problems.
And so I'm very interested in hearing about any problems that people have that they think would benefit from this. So please let me know, and I'd be very happy to work with you. So yeah, that's a big, big thing that we need to get more test cases out there. And we need to be able to, we also need to test the scalability of Python's simple XML RPC server. I've heard stories on either side where people say, oh yeah, it can handle /.effect fine, or oh no, it'll crumble under 10 concurrent connections. But if that actually happens to be a problem, there's very good alternatives that we can fall back on, like Medusa and Twisted.
They both implement XML RPC.
Actually, I might just move it to Twisted like this weekend, because it's so simple to do in Twisted.
And then I have to include Twisted with Sage.
Only on the server, though.
Yeah, sure. It's still.
Yeah, okay, fine. That's one thing that we have to think about. But, yeah. Right, but it's very simple to move to another system if we have to. So we need to test the scalability of the server, because if 1,000, I mean, it's very different from 10 people, yeah. 10 computers are connecting to it versus 1,000.
Yeah, you could easily imagine 1,000.
Right. And another thing that a little lower on my to-do list is to be able to generate fancy statistics and output as an HTML file, because everybody loves stats. So for example, we could say, you know, this distributed network is running at XYZ teraflops, hopefully. And so many people are connecting with Linux, and so many people are connecting with Windows, what have you. So there's a lot of statistics that we can gather from this, and they're very interesting. And a little higher, although it's lower on this list, is to make it very easy for researchers and mathematicians to submit their jobs, because if it's too complicated, then no one will use it. So, for example, right now, I think that people can just put all their jobs in .sh files, put in a zip file, and use CGI form to upload it to the server. We'll automatically uncompress it, add all the jobs to the queue, and then just email you when it's done. So it should be very, very simple for someone to submit a job. So yeah, that's very important for me. And we need to protect ourselves against mischief, and that's also very important, because what really drives these distributed computing facilities is a sort of friendly competition where you gain points by doing more work. And people falls into statistics. People love to be number one, like, I've donated a million years of CPU time, blah, blah, blah. And there's, when it becomes popular, inevitably, there are going to be people who try to cheat their way to the top. So we have to figure out how to protect ourselves against that. And, oh yeah, and then hopefully I'll be getting paid for this by Google.
It's looking good.
Because William applied to, so this is actually going, if we get accepted, this actually is going to be done for the Python Software Foundation. And I'm actually writing it to be so general that we can, it doesn't even have to be Sage. It could be any program that just gives you output. You can apply this to a lot of things. So it's basically a more general framework. It's not specifically for Sage. And yeah, so hopefully I can get sponsored for this work at Google over the summer.
You get a free t-shirt.
And a free t-shirt, yes.
From Google.
And a resume booster too.
Yeah.
I think I'm over my time.
No, 10 to 25.
Okay, good. 26. So, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I was curious, what if you have interdependency? For instance, like I was thinking in terms of factoring.
Okay.
You're running these jobs hoping that one of them finds a factor. Once one of them finds a factor, you want to kill all the rest of the jobs since they're ready.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Or I'm sure there's other
options. Why don't you explain in like 1 minute the situation you're thinking of with ECM?
Yeah, so I'm working on this thing called elliptic curve factorization.
Okay.
The idea is you can pick a curve and then you basically multiply points on this curve with the hopes that it will give you a factor. And the idea is that, you know, most curves don't give you a factor, but you can kind of assign a probability to a curve giving you a factor, and you try to run it on a whole bunch of curves. And these can all be done independently, but once you have a factor, you really don't care about, you know, running the rest of your curves. You might be running on 1,000 curves.
Okay, so once you find an answer, you want to be able to...
So the interrupt signal to everybody else saying stop.
Yeah.
Wasting your time.
Hard to do on this.
We can figure it out.
Hard to do on when you have clients pulling for jobs. Uh-huh. Harder to do. You can maybe implement a callback and do it, but we can. I mean, this is very flexible, so we can turn this design upside down and make it a push framework. Because I think you've written Sage so that you can actually create remote Sage jobs. And if we do that, it'd be very easy to kill those jobs. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's doable, but
for the way I have it, you have to have a connection open the whole time,
uh-huh.
Which is kind of weird because.
But you still can kill it though, right?
Yeah, but it would be nice if you know, the client connects, gets what it's supposed to do, disconnects, you know, works all night long, and then can reconnect to send back the result.
Right, so but that's what it's
called. The only way you'd be able to kill it would be to have it connect like every 5 minutes to check to see whether it should stop running. But we could do that.
You could also just.
But you have to have two Python processes running on the machine on somebody's desktop, on the client machine, because one would have to kill the other one.
Oh. Right,
you'd have to have one, because you're in the factor thing will be in some C code running.
Right.
That's not going to stop every 5 minutes and check to see whether it should be killed. We could have another server or another process that checks back.
Actually, if we do it that way, it would be very easy because I can just implement it
just to
thread it and just make it an unblocking thread. One thread would be running the C code, the other thread checks periodically the server and says, we found the answer, stop doing this, kill the job,
send
and then get the next job.
Yeah.
And it would be also very easy to remove all those jobs in the job database once we finally found an answer, and then we can move on to the next one.
So, very good point.
Once you find the answer, you're going to both have to verify it.
Right.
And worst case, you know, everybody's only going to have one extra work unit anyway.
Yeah.
Fortunately, integer factorization is easy to verify. Just multiply this.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, but it's really good that we should keep this in mind from the beginning of the design.
Yeah. So that's why I want to hear as many problems as possible.
Like, at every possible level, I want Sage to be interruptible in some sense.
Yeah.
So, because, you know, scientists are fickle. They throw something out to get it.
They figure it out. Yeah.
Before it's done, they solve the problem via some theorem. So, then you want to be able to just cancel the whole thing quickly and easily. Okay, great. So, thank you. So, one thing you're right to brainstorm about is methods to get a big website of distributed calculations that can be done. I think that would be just a good thing to collect together as motivation for this that haven't been done. So as you were saying, you need more examples of specific things.
Right.
So he has a good one that you should talk
about. Yeah, definitely. That sounds really...
Which is examples just factoring integers in certain properties where they're not too big, you know they're composite, and you can use ECM to do it, but it's only practical if you distribute it, otherwise it takes 100 days or something. So
yeah, I mean, as long if you can write that as a Sage script, I think I could do it. Like, it works to the point now where I can actually just feed it with
it.
So, yeah.
Okay, so, excellent. Right.
So,
hi, everybody.
No, just about everybody here, but I'm Tom. Who here knows HTML? Great. So what I'm going to be talking about today is Ajax, which is an extension of the HTTP protocol, not even so much, but it's an extension of JavaScript using XML requests, which kind of just lays on top of HTTP to make web pages more robust. So AJAX stands for Asynchronous JavaScript and HTML, I mean XML. So the asynchronous bit is the real key. People have been using JavaScript and XML together for quite a long time. The asynchronous bit is you can use JavaScript to send a request from a page. So instead of the old model where you write an HTML web page, you grab a page and put it on the browser. Now what's going on is this page has a script which sends a sub-request, and it says, give me this piece of information. And then it displays it in some other way on the web page. I've implemented an example of this.
You can't tap, you have to click.
Oh.
You actually click the button.
Okay, so this is very simple. I'll walk through the code a little bit first. This function is this get a XML HTTP object I got from just an AJAX tutorial. Writing JavaScript, it's rare that you want to just do something yourself for the first time, because there's a lot of developers out there who spend a lot of time writing things that work in multiple browsers. So this is designed so it'll work in...
Could you say something about just JavaScript?
Oh, yeah.
What do you know about JavaScript?
Zero.
Okay.
Right.
JavaScript.
So, is HTML? And I want to hear how you describe JavaScript.
Okay. So JavaScript uses a C syntax. It uses a syntax that's somewhere between C and Java.
You're looking at it right there.
You're looking at it right here. This function uses no semicolons, which still bugs me a lot.
Right.
But so you don't absolutely need them, but they're nice. it's not Java. You're not loading the Java library. It doesn't have a lot to do with Java other than it's, I believe, a product of Sun.
I looked at Wikipedia and it was written first by some guy and it was named something else and then Sun like convinced him to call it Java.
Okay, that's terrible.
They used to be called something different.
So
it was written completely independently from Java.
Okay, so it's a political issue which I try to avoid. And so it's now considered a subset of something called ECMAScript, which I don't know what ECMA stands for, but it's another super language, somewhat similar to XML being a super language of HTML. ECMAScript came out after JavaScript, and now JavaScript is considered a subset of it. Do people know what XML is? Okay, so XML is generalized HTML. It stands for extensible markup language. The extensible part of that means that you can apply it to whatever your purpose is. So in HTML, you create your HTML object, and then you make your head tag, and so on. And you're all familiar with this. Now, XML uses the same tag structure. So if we were to, like the XML RPC, you would start out with XML RPC. And this is a new object. So I'm not exactly sure how this works, but how XML RPC works. But this is just a generic format of a file, is to have it modular enough that you can throw any data structure into XML, and it'll be handleable by anything that can handle text. And then it's written to and read by people who understand this XML RPC object. So you could have arbitrary properties. You could say, server, and your tags, if there's just like in Java, sorry, in HTML, if you're in your body tag and you write br, that's no longer considered good form. The reason is, if we've got just these, just the two angle brackets, that's considered an opening tag. So when you close a tag, you use that forward slash, and now we put a forward slash here.
It's just like a short.
It's like a shortcut to have.
It's
like to pass those.
Is it also legal to have br and then an empty space and then slash br?
You probably could get away with it. Different browsers are going to handle that in very different ways. Most would probably just interpret it as two line breaks. But for XML, that would be fine to do. So say we have a server tag that's just alone, you'd say, whatever the server address is. And then you'd have, your data. And then you could have sub-properties of that. And it'll look just like HTML, only coming from an HTML background, you won't know what, any of these in particular mean, except that they've got names. So it makes it both easy to parse from a programming perspective and easy to read as a human. So that's all XML is. So back to JavaScript. JavaScript is a very fickle language because there's a lot of different browsers that are made by a lot of different people. Similar to XML, you have a bunch of different formats. In this case, the format is, well-defined, more or less well-defined, and everybody's interpretation is different. Largely due to politics, I believe, because Microsoft doesn't want the open source people's stuff to work the same, because they want people to switch and just only use their thing. Other companies are also guilty of this. So the difficulty in programming in JavaScript is learning how different browsers handle everything. The way that it works in general, you can put a script tag more or less anywhere in HTML. My habit is to put it between the head and the body tag, but you can really have a script tag just show up anywhere inside your HTML. It can also be included as a .js file. I don't have an example of that here. It's rather simple to find just if you search for it. So this block of script is interpreted when the page is loaded. I believe it happens before anything comes after it. So all that I do here is define functions. When I come down, I'll talk about what's going on in here in a minute. When I come down into the form, you can specify this on click in a button. So I can show you that this button sadly doesn't have a name. I don't know why I just wanted to put it on the screen. So this button, you see just a shadow here, is generated here. And when you click on it, this is called an event. The onClick is an event. That name is a carryover from Java. It's one of those things that this is similar to Java in many ways. So once this onClick event occurs, it calls the calculate function. So we can see this calculate function here. Now this gets into the real core AJAX. I'll show you this operating in a second. There's a current box variable that I've used in other places. Forget about the current box here and here. Here I'm saying the current box is called calc output. What that's referring to, an important thing about newer HTML, I'm not sure when this is all implemented or if this is actually style sheets, but there are div tags here. So this div ID calc output is now our current box. The cool thing about div tags is that they just wrap a certain amount of HTML without changing a lot of formatting. So when I take this calc output, I'm saying, okay, this is my scratch pad right now. This calculate, I should scroll up just a little bit. Okay, so this calculate gets an XML HTTP object. So that's just a wrapper, the one that I told you I got from somebody else, that gets a generic object that will make an XML call. So it'll make another request to the server to get a piece like I told you before. It then calls this open, so it opens a port and sends and prepares a request. Now it submits some information and then it sends it. What this is doing is it's looking at, so this long string, the document.calcform.input.value, references this form. So this form is called calcform. So the object-oriented part of JavaScript is there's a main object called document. Inside of that is all the names of the forms. In all the forms is all of the input types. So we've got this input named input, and we expect the user to put something there. So if we put in a calculation, say,
click the button.
Clicking. So what this is actually doing is submitting this string into a Python script. You'll notice, well, you can't really tell right now, but this is talking to another server, or I mean that it's talking back to the server again. But what I've done down here,
where are lines 1 and 2?
Lines 1 and 2.
There's some setup information.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Okay, so using more of the features of CSS, cascading style sheets, I've made this form, which places boxes where you can put random things, and there are four different pages that I've called five, I guess, blankness, image, text, HTML, and sage calculator. So I can change this, and what's happening is this is putting another request out to the server and replacing the text inside this div tag. When I say new box, it actually makes another div tag, which, just to be silly, we can actually load the Sage calculator, which happens to reside on this server. There's really no point to that. If you submit, it'll go off to the Sage calculator page. But this is just to show that you can put a lot of different stuff into a div tag with an XML request, which is really the key of JavaScript, of Ajax. So now that we've got all this content, if I reload the page, everything disappears. Except for the fact of 2006. So if I put in some new boxes, now when I hit this, you see that it takes a second and it loads that from Python straight into the HTML, and we haven't reloaded the page or anything.
So I have a question. So yeah. Not reloading a page is actually an illusion, right? It just reloads the stuff that's in that div tag.
It doesn't even reload it.
So how does it get the new information?
So what the new information is coming from, if we were saying reloading it, I would think that we're just like doing the same thing every time. The key to this is that we get we're just submitting arbitrary data back to the server, and it's responding.
And then the browser updates this stuff, and then the tag corresponds.
Right. Okay. So I hadn't gotten to that part of the code, because this is where it gets hairy. Okay, so when we call the get XMLHTTP object, we pass it this state change. This is a function. Funny thing about JavaScript, you can actually pass a function by not calling or not putting parentheses on it. So this function is then referenced up in that that large other function. And what happens is once this thing gets done, this function here is this checks for whether or not the page has been loaded. One of these is in Explorer, one of these is Netscape, I'm not really sure, or Mozilla. But what happens is it says document get element by ID. So it finds that current box, whatever box we're looking at. Generalize that so we can make those new boxes that we're putting arbitrary things into. Also, I can use the same function on our calc output. So once that happens, it grabs the response text from the server, so what the server says back to us once we make our call. and it puts that into the HTML inside the current box. So it'll, due to security issues, you've got to, you can only talk back to your original server. You can't say, call Google. One of the things I tried to do was put the AJAX calculator on here. It's even at the same domain name, just with a different port, it wouldn't go. So in JavaScript, another thing that, that you have to think about is there are security considerations. So you can't load things from certain places. In some browsers, you can talk between two windows. In others, you can't. So I could change the HTML on another window inside a div tag. I think Firefox lets you do it, but others don't, or some versions do, and others don't. It's a finicky thing. I'm at a loss for new content. Does anybody have any questions?
So is the response text formatted HTML, or is it just plain text?
It's actually whatever you want. When I was passing as, it depends what the server calls it. If the server passes back content type is text plain, uh-huh. It'll just load it as plain text.
Okay.
Otherwise, it'll load it as, if the server says, you know, this is text HTML, it'll show HTML.
And it could be also be binding, right? So you can send back like an image too.
I haven't tried that. I'd like to see it.
View the source.
Yeah.
You can't see the really things.
No.
But when you save the page, is it you can see?
Good question.
Because it's kind of like all this data. Is like, where is it sitting?
In memory.
The DOM.
Yeah,
it's all in memory.
But like on your machine's
memory.
It's kind of open. To the right open.
I guess that'll work.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I'll learn them these days. Wow, so it
there
actually
now,
saved
now
it.
Now they control you. It should be there. We'll see.
And yeah, now
control level.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Or maybe it'll be there. I don't know. It has to be there, because otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be damned. So, yeah, it'll go straight into the div tags.
Yeah, that's neat.
Good question.
It's really, yeah. It's neat because you're like modifying dynamically what the web page is rather than downloading a new one.
Right, right.
Like if the web page had 50 images in it, which could easily happen,
yeah.
You don't want to have to download all 50 images again or something. Whereas this just changed a little part that might be.
So this like DOM thing is like data stored in the browser's
memory?
It's in memory, I never
think of it. What does DOM stand for?
Data?
Document optional.
Document optional.
So, when you think about ways to improve the Sage web interface that we write,
that was the
how can you use AJAX
put in the
to? Yeah, I have this huge to-do list for things I wish it would do.
Right.
And you could obviously imagine rewriting the whole thing to be better in various ways. How? Right now, it doesn't use any of this asynchronous JavaScript at all. It just uses a couple of JavaScript things to get it going. But like every time if you do 2+2 in the current web interface, it submits a form and then it redraws the entire web page and sends the entire web page back.
Yeah.
But you like brainstorm? What are your ideas for?
So, okay, yeah. The key is now that we're talking to, we can look at a single input at a time. This calculator here. Is a real proof of concept for that because we have a single input corresponding to a single output object on the page. The real key to that is that we can just overwrite the old input from that from the last time that it was run or just create it from scratch right there. So when we've got this notebook style, has everybody here seen the server as it's standing?
No.
Okay.
That's
beautiful. Do you want to bring it up on here?
Well, I can bring it up on here. So.
Okay.
Oops, there should be one. So, this is an example, but you can just go to the bottom and you can type something. Yeah, so that's a new thing.
Yeah. So on Tuesday, I added this new feature where you can actually plot on this and it'll show. Instead of just saying, yes, I made a plot object, and not showing it. Okay, so what's going on is Sage is currently running on William's computer. And it's running a server at port 8000. So we're using our browser to interface with Sage directly. This is really valuable because a lot of time and effort has been put into browsers to make them work nice and look good. And anybody with HTML experience suddenly can make a nice interface. So this is the goal on Sage.
And absolutely everybody has a web browser.
Everybody's got a browser. Once you install Sage, you can just run it in server mode and use it from your browser. The goal here is to make the interface more robust. Mathematica is a good example of a nice notebook interface where we've got multiple lines with the output corresponding to the input at every point.
Or you can go back and edit the input.
Right, so you can go back, change the input. Maybe I didn't want sine. I'll say sine plus cosine.
It won't work.
No?
Unless you have to just make a lambda function.
Oh, very good. Okay. Then I'll just do cosine. And it just works.
Shift tab.
Okay. So the real cool thing about this is that a lot of work has already been done for us. Now to make it more like Mathematica, we don't want to be exactly like them, of course, but you know, the better we can get, you know, they're a good benchmark.
An example of real work. If I want to change my font, it's trivial. I just go in and change it. I don't want to have to write stuff to do that.
Increase the font size.
Yeah, you can just can easily just change the, make it small, make it big. My eyes get tired.
So a few of the things that I want to use Ajax for. First off, style sheets is going to be really big in this. Cascading style sheets, one of the style options is display. You can set it to block and it shows up. You can set it to none and it makes an object vanish. So we can expand and contract these inputs and outputs, add new lines on a whim. Instead of having to submit a new page and have it rebuild the whole thing, we just say, I'm in a new box, and JavaScript will do that for us. Doesn't bog down the server at all. Also, it would be nice to have the plot show up in another window, for example. I'm not really sure what else we're going to need of it, but it'll be very helpful.
Things like the cancel button, so when you have a computation.
Oh, right, yeah.
That's where you have to send a request back.
I don't know. Whether Ajax will help, or maybe some another thing is
Ajax can help. We'll
what about this, like verbose? So when you use Sage to do a calculation, sometimes it takes a long time, and you can set it to verbose the output as it goes.
Right.
And I don't know if it just would help with that, but it would be nice if you could have it, you know, add line after line as of verbose output as it gets determined, kind of like a tail, sort of tail dash up.
You know how it has those four states, like one ready state. I've seen it like one ready state, two, it has an image of a little clock going.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Like first spinners.
Yeah. The little spinners.
So yeah, that sort of thing would be good.
So yeah, we could
do that for any running calculation.
Try something like that and have it kind of loading as it goes.
Yeah.
If we have two servers running. Or if we change the server to fork a process whenever another request comes in, we'll be able to kill other processes. We'll be able to stop while running a certain command.
Here's a crucial thing. So if I want to compute the echelon form of this matrix, it's nice to be able to watch what it's doing as it does it. And currently with the web interface, you just sit there and wait, you know, an indeterminate amount of time, you get no feedback at all. And it'd be much better if it would, you know, every time some verbose output's computed, if that were stuck into the web page somehow. Can you figure out how to do that?
Very good question. At first glance, it would be kind of a push concept, which HTTP doesn't support. On the other hand, we could set up a timer in JavaScript that would say every second, you know, do we have any output? Do we have any output?
Yeah, exactly.
But again, that would require forking off for every request.
Why?
Because we would need the server to be able to serve multiple pages at a time. Mm-hmm. Because there would be one process running. I see an ugly way to do that.
Yeah.
That we'll have to.
Okay, we'll figure it out then. But I think that the answer is a JavaScript timer.
Yeah. One thing that I can see doing is trying something, seeing if it takes less than 5 seconds, and then sending something back to the page that's going to say, this is going to take more than 5 seconds, show a loading thing. Mm-hmm. And then background it somehow. And then
this is, I think, having this verbose functionality where it tells you as it's going is one of the nice things about using a console. Yes. I don't know how in Mathematica does it, like, will it print a little as it goes if you turn on?
Oh, no.
I don't know how you do that.
Wait, you'll look at all at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Errors show up one at a time.
But it's really a crucial thing when you're running a big calculation. You want to kind of watch the state as it evolves. And the console, that works really nicely. And the web interface, it needs to work nicely.
Yeah.
And you also need to be able to cancel in the middle when you decide, oh, it's going to take too long. You need that to just work.
So I think the key is to figure out how to fork.
Fork in time. Okay, so any other questions or comments?
Yeah. What was the CSS concept you mentioned earlier about boxes or something? What was it?
Div tags.
It was a div tag?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This code is available at modular.math/boothpin.
Math Washington U.
Yeah.
I'm going to put everything up.
Okay, yeah. William's going to put this stuff up.
Like, if you go to my website, there's...
One of the first links is talks, and I'll have a link to all the talks from today. See, my talks. So, for example, you can find... That's weird. Must be the network connection's down. Yep. My laptop has been mysteriously dropping the network connection to my office lately. But in any case, under talks on my website, right here, the top link will be to this talk within an hour or two. So, yeah, so right here. And currently the top link is to the talk last week. It'll have everything gathered together. Come on. Ah, there it is. See? So that's last week with audio and everything and so on and so on.
Right. So, are there any other comments or questions? Okay, I'm going to make my talk 5 to 10 minutes. Okay. Thank you.
So, all I'm going to do is just show you a couple of commands and give you a little sense of how doing linear algebra is a little bit different in Sage than in, say, Mathematica or Perry or Gap or any of these other systems. It's actually very similar to how it works in Magma. And so you'll also basically be learning how to do linear algebra in Magma as well. So this is an example of making a 2x2 matrix in Sage. And one thing that's different here is you explicitly say what ring or field you want the elements to live in. So evaluate that. And then you get this matrix. That's how the matrix prints out. So that's just an example. The format is matrix, and then you give a ring, you give the dimensions of the matrix, and a list of all the elements, and they're filled in row-wise.
So how do you know what the standard notation for the ring is? I mean, how did you know? Pretty classic Q, Q, and not
yes.
Q, or whatever.
So there's a large number of different rings. Q would also work, actually.
So Q would work as well?
Yes, rational field. The best thing, though, is rational field, which will give you the rational field. That's a function that returns a copy of the rational field. If you look in the reference manual, it'll have a large number of different examples. So documentation, reference manual, or tutorial. But if you look under rings, there's a
big... It's got a list of the accepted notations for rings.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically what you can do is you can look for a ring that you want to use and then look at the examples of usage. So for example, how would you refer to Z mod n Z? How do you make Z mod n Z? So you click here on under standard commutative rings, you click on Z mod n Z. It's a little slow because it's, okay. And then you you look for an example, and sure enough there's one right at the top, the ring of integers. So you say integers of 97 to make that one. There's always a word that you can use to build a ring, but there's often some shorthand notation that you don't necessarily have to depend on. For finite fields, GF, for Galois field. But you can also spell it out, finite field, like that. But the best thing to do is to look in the documentation for an example and then copy what the example does. And anything you see in examples, you can just paste right in and use. Okay, so that's an example. A large amount of standard arithmetic is implemented for matrices. So, for example, matrix multiplication, but there's a lot more. There's even some pretty optimized code for computing permanence of non-square matrices. I'm not even quite sure what that means. I mean, I know the definition because I helped write it, but I'm not sure its combinatorial significance, but it is really important for certain people. This guy, Jaap Spies, sent me some code, and he ended up using it to find some new combinatorial invariants that people hadn't found before. So he ran a Sage calculation for about 2 days to do that. But just Sage has a lot of sort of matrix operations available. And then some like obvious ones, the inverse of a matrix, the Kerr-Poly of a matrix, and so on. So I'll compute this one live. So yeah, that's the Kerr-Poly.
Okay, next you can compute kernels and decompositions and so on. So typically, when you ask for the kernel in a lot of computer algebra systems, you get a list of vectors that form a basis for the kernel. That's a typical thing you might get. In Sage, like in Magma, when you ask for the kernel, you get something that is a vector space with a given basis. So here we make a 3x3 matrix with integer entries, though we're viewing them as rationals. That's crucial because the meaning of the kernel of a matrix is different if you view it as a matrix over the integers instead of a matrix over the rationals. For example, a basis over, well, a basis is just a different mathematical object. So here what we'll do is we'll compute the characteristic polynomial of the matrix, and that will give us a sense of which kernels we should consider, and then we'll consider those kernels and compute them here.
So hit Shift-Enter. to evaluate. And then let me just move it like that. Okay, so what it did was it computed the characteristic polynomial, the Karapalli factors, and so it is interesting to compute the eigenspaces, and you get those from computing the kernel of the matrix plugged into each of the factors.
So it automatically produced the factorization without you asking for it?
No, I did actually ask for it right here, where a factor
of Karapalli,
yeah. Yes. But it writes it nicely, at least. So I didn't do that without asking. So the kernel of A plus 2 is, it's not just a list of vectors, it's a vector space of degree 3, because it's sitting in a three-dimensional space, but it has dimension 2. And it's given by this basis matrix. It's the span of the rows of this matrix. And the kernel of A minus 3 is the span of the rows of that matrix. So instead of thinking, the program outputting the kernel as a list of vectors, because it thinks, so, well, you know, the only thing you can represent in the computer is a list of vectors, I mean, you can perfectly well represent a vector space in the computer. Just call it a vector space.
And W is the notation for the kernel. Is that why you're...
Here I'm just letting W equal the kernel.
Okay.
So I make the matrix A minus 3, then I call the function kernel on it, and then I get the output and I call that W.
Yeah,
but so I could have called it something else.
But that's the name of the...
Yes, kernel. Exactly. Yeah. So for example, here I could say, you know, print W.dimension, and it computed the dimension that got printed at the very end. And W has a whole bunch of functions that you can call on it. There's currently no easy way in the web interface to get a list of all functions that you can call on an object. But that's something that I hope... It seems like Ajax would be perfect for that, because you could be at this point and it hits some keystroke combination or do something, and it would send a request back to the server and ask, what are all the functions you can call on W? And then I don't know what it would do with the answer, but maybe pop it up in another window or maybe it would... I don't know. I mean, the design is interesting. Maybe it would just stick it right here, and it would disappear as soon as you type a keystroke. I don't know. I'm not even sure how it should tell us what all the possible functions are. But in any case, each of these are actual vector spaces. So we print W again. It's an actual vector space. So I print a W. It's this vector space. And it has an ambient space in which it sits called its ambient module. And that's just the vector space of dimension 3 over the rationals. You can do all kinds of standard operations on vector spaces. For example, you can add them together, compute intersections of subspaces, and so on. It's all implemented using, at the end of the day, echelon form type things. But here you see that the sum of these two kernels, the sum of the two eigenspaces, is the whole space, and the intersection of the two is, of course, zero. Okay, going down. Yes,
this
please.
This matrix is empty? Should
yes.
It be zero? It should be zero. It's generated
print
zero.
Zero.
It's not empty.
It's the matrix with zero rows. So zero by zero matrices, zero by n matrices are all allowed at stage. But the... the design question is, how do you print out a matrix with zero rows? And, you know, printing out a blank string would probably not be very enlightening. So currently, Sage just prints out this to represent any matrix of either zero rows or zero columns. But it is very important to at least allow creation of zero by zero or zero by n or n by zero matrices. Otherwise, your programs will break for stupid reasons. A lot of systems don't allow these special cases and it causes all kinds of trouble. But I could certainly see that that's a good idea. Maybe it should print
right.
A zero.
The basis is supposed to be a non-zero vector. So how can
the basis is empty for the zero space. Yeah. So the basis matrix has zero rows. I mean, we could get, so we could make like I is the intersection. And then, so it would be very nice if I could insert a new box right here, but that function isn't available yet. Then I can ask for the basis matrix. So at the very bottom, we get this little matrix. And I can ask for the parent space of the basis matrix, and that will tell us it's a space of zero matrices that have zero rows and three columns, zero by three matrices. So, I admit that possibly the printing format is confusing. But I'm not sure what would be better. The next little example illustrates that not only can you do everything over Q or other fields,
You also have at least all the standard linear algebra over Z. And everything reduces to having a Hermite normal form algorithm. And the complexity and speed of everything depends on how fast that one algorithm is. But here's an example where you compute a kernel and another kernel, and then print them out of that same matrix, but now considered over Z.
So the first, the second kernel before, if we go up, was 1, 0, minus 1 fifth. That's definitely not going to be the kernel over Z, because that vector isn't even in Z. So if we go down and look at what we get, so I'm going to evaluate this block now, and it's going to print out the kernel of A plus 2 and the kernel of A minus 3, but over the integers. Okay, so it prints them out.
The kernel of A plus 2 is this, and then the kernel of A minus 3 is that, over the integers. So it's a little, the basis is a little bit different. The bases are always given in reduced row echelon form, or the analog of reduced row echelon form over your ring. For the integers, the analog is what's called Hermite normal form.
You can also do various standard operations, like add together the two modules. There was a stupid checking of compatibility bug, so that won't work if you try it at home, unless you upgrade.
But if you take the two eigenspaces over Z and add them together, you don't get the whole space now. You get a subspace of the whole space. And you can see that it has index 5 inside of Z3. So I'm illustrating really that there's a specific 3x3 matrix. And if you know about modular forms, it's the Hecke operator of T2 on level 11. But probably that doesn't mean anything to you. But inside of here, you have the kernel of A minus 3, and you have the kernel of A plus 2. And if you add together these two, you don't get the whole space. There's some index.
Okay. But it's neat that you can do, using exactly the same notation, you can do linear algebra over Z, over Q, actually over a very generic, very general basis.
You only get really interesting operations over Z and fields. You can't really do too much in other cases yet. Euclidean domains you should be able to do everything with, but nobody's implemented for Sage a Hermite normal form algorithm over general Euclidean domains yet. Here's an example of a sparse matrix. So I create a sparse matrix, print out its first row, and then I compute its echelon form. I did that in another window, and it showed you as it went. But this computes the kernel, I mean not the kernel, but the reduced row echelon form of a 2,000 by 1,000 sparse matrix, and it takes about 20 seconds. And it doesn't use very much memory. And the way it's able to do that is, well, a sparse matrix is all the operations, everything, the interface to sparse matrices are exactly like the interface, or is exactly like the interface to dense matrices in Sage. The only difference is that when you make the matrix in the first place, let me go back to that slide. I just changed the size so you could see it better, but unfortunately, moved. Okay, so the only difference is that when you make your sparse matrix, or your space of sparse matrices, you give the sparse equals true option. So in Sage, really, the best way to make a matrix is to make the space of all matrices. It seems counterintuitive. If you make the space of all matrices of over a certain ring or field with a certain number of rows and a certain number of columns, this command makes the space of all matrices that have 2,000 rows and 1,000 columns, and such that they're internally represented as sparse matrices, meaning you only store the non-zero entries. And then this makes a random element where the probability that a given entry will be non-zero is 0.01. So one out of every 100 of the entries in a given row is non-zero. So roughly 10 of the entries in this row are non-zero. And
then in the next slide, you do a calculation. The calculation is exactly the same as it would have been for a dense matrix. You compute the echelon form. But it doesn't use much memory because it does the Gaussian elimination entirely using sparse arithmetic. Also, you can make matrices over very generic base rings.
So here you make a polynomial ring in two variables over the integers. And this is the notation that was added recently so that the variables will be named x and y. It's similar to magma. The only difference is that there's a dot there. And you print it out, the space of all, or it's the ring of all two, sorry, the ring of all polynomials in two variables over the integers. Then you make the space of all 2x2 matrices. If you don't give a second argument to the matrix space function, it just assumes it's the same as the first one, then you print out the space of matrices.
So it's the full matrix space of 2x2 dense matrices. If I would say instead sparse equals true, then it'll do the same thing, but it'll make sparse matrices. The only difference between a dense and a sparse matrix is its internal representation is sparse. Yes?
Is that R dot brackets standard Python?
No, that's not allowed in Python. It's invalid syntax in Python, which is why we use it. So Sage has a preparser, and what it does is it turns this line into a different line, namely, if you just say pre-parse, and you can tell exactly what it does.
So it turns it into, oh, I have to print it out. See you later. So it prints it out, and what it does is it turns it into the line that's given there. It makes the polynomial ring, then it assigns the names x and y to the generators, and then it sets x and y equal to those generators in the current scope. Okay? So it's a nice shortcut, and but it's not something that's available. So it's extremely useful practice to be able to use this. If you're writing a .py file, that'll be part of the Sage library, you can't use that. But if you're writing a .sage file or using the using Sage interactively, then you can use this. Otherwise, you have to use a slightly more cumbersome notation. But it's good because it's distinct from anything that's actually used in Python, so you won't accidentally use this notation and not have the interpreter tell you about it if you're making a .py file. And it works, it's not just a polynomial ring thing. This works for most objects in Sage. There's a function that allows you to make them, and then you give what ring they're over or something, the number of generators that you have. And you can use exactly this notation for all these different things. So for polynomial rings, for affine spaces, for projective spaces, for spaces of modular forms, et cetera, et cetera. There's a wide range of different spaces, or groups, generators of a group. If you make a group and use this notation, it names all the generators of the group as a connect. Okay, so next you can make a matrix with entries in this funny polynomial ring and do arithmetic with it, like compute the determinant, compute the inverse, etc. So what happens is all the standard linear algebra operations that you would do with matrices, they're implemented just in Python, in interpreted Python, so that they'll work over absolutely any ring at all. However, if you make a matrix, say, over the rational numbers, then it will create a C object using that's been implemented using Pyrex, and it can do some subset of those operations very, very quickly, whatever I happen to have implemented or somebody else has added to it. So you have a generic matrix class that can do anything, but possibly slowly, but over a completely generic base ring. Then you have special code that's compiled that's vastly faster when applicable. And that's really how the model works. And the very last thing is, if you make a matrix, just going back to our original matrix, you can obtain the corresponding matrix in gap by saying gap of the matrix, the corresponding matrix in pari by saying pari of the matrix, and the corresponding matrix in magma by saying magma of the matrix. And the resulting object that you get in each case really is an object in that system, and you can use commands from that system on it. For example, here, if I say magma of m dot echelon form, it'll use magma to compute and output the echelon form. So you'll notice I only illustrated that with three different systems. There aren't coercion functions written like that for any of the other systems like singular. So there's a project to be done just to add a whole bunch more coercion functions. Okay, and that's my talk, or what I wanted to tell you. It's just a brief introduction to how linear algebra works. It's really, really different than a lot of systems. Like in Mathematica, matrices, like, as far as I can tell, a matrix is just something like this. It's just a list of lists. And in a lot of systems, that's all a matrix is. But a matrix in Sage, or in Magma, is an element of a space of matrices, and that space of matrices has a specific ring that you're considering the matrices as being over, and has a number of rows and a number of columns. So certain operations, such as kernel, make sense.
that wouldn't necessarily be well defined otherwise, but it could be really confusing otherwise. And also, you don't have weirdness where different entries of your matrix are in completely different rings, so that things are potentially confusing. Of course, if you want to compute purely symbolically, you could. You can, for example, use maxima from SAGE. I mean, there are some potential drawbacks to having to specify exactly what ring all of your entries are in. But then you should use maybe Perry or magma. Or not magma, sorry. Magma doesn't help at all, but Perry or maxima or something, which is a little bit more symbolic. But for a lot of problems, being able to specify exactly where your entries all live and being able to think about vector spaces, spaces of matrices, etc., really makes the whole interaction with the computer a lot more like what you think about when you're doing mathematics. Instead of you're converting between, you know, lists and lists of lists to some abstract thing that you think about, which is vector spaces and so on. So especially if you know a lot about linear algebra and the theory, then this is particularly nice. Okay, so any questions? Yes?
What would you like to add with SAGE on the topic of linear algebra? Like on the email that I got, you said you were going to talk about some of the things you want SAGE
to do. There's a bunch of stuff. I mean, the main thrust is that there are a lot of interesting algorithms that are really fast for linear algebra that have not been implemented in SAGE, or as far as I know, in any open source system that you can hope to really use. There's some, so for numerical linear algebra, there's a lot that's been done already, though SAGE doesn't take advantage of it at all. So that would be one thing. Make it so that if you make a matrix with floating point entries, with real number entries, to some precision, that it can do things efficiently with that matrix by taking advantage of numeric, which is one of Python's numerical packages, or NumPy, or one of the other ones. So that would be one thing to do. Another is that there should be asymptotically fast algorithms for doing a lot of operations with matrices. Currently, I've implemented some pretty powerful algorithms for linear algebra, but there are even better algorithms out there, which are implemented, for example, in magma. I don't know if where else they're implemented, if anywhere, but it would be very good to get, they have to get put into SAGE at some point. So I want those to be in SAGE. Coercions from SAGE into other systems is sort of halfway done. Half the systems work and half of them don't. So that would be another thing to add. There's not nearly enough documentation in the files that define matrices. So, I mean, if you just go to the SAGE website, click on free and open source, free and open at the bottom, and then look at the matrix files, if you click on just any random file in here, you'll be disappointed at the number of examples, I hope. Okay, well, that one, so far, not so disappointing, but now look here. This is horrible. Look at the pitiful state of the examples. And these are really crucial. So do you see any examples of that? None of these functions have any examples, which means that they're probably broken, to be a little cynical. But there should be examples of every single one of these rather than just a few random ones. So that's a really important thing, because when you... Oh, sorry.
Oh, you know that... Have you heard of a doc test?
Yes.
Oh, does that work for this?
Yeah. I have a doc test preparser that turns this into a proper doc test. Awesome. And then it runs the standard doc test on it. And I really want the doc test behavior to be totally different than... I mean, for SAGE, the doc test behavior that I want is different than what Python provides. So there are two things. One, I want the input to be fully pre-parsed by the SAGE preparser, because I want the stuff that you have here to be what you would want to type, or you know, what a user should type in. And it should be that anything that you can type in at the shell will work in the documentation strings. And that wouldn't be the case if I used Python's doc test system, but directly. That's one problem. The other problem is, and it's really related to the first problem, the scope. So with Python's doc test, the scope is the scope of the current file. That's where the documentation tests are run. But actually, I want the scope to be the scope of the interpreter when you're typing at the command line. So what I do is I have a preparser that runs through the file. If there are any comments on the side that say optional, then it won't test that line. Since there are a lot of things that require mathematics, and I don't want to test those unless I tell it explicitly to do so. And I do have it explicitly. I mean, you just have to say sage-test-optional, and we'll do the optional ones. But it runs through this, extracts out all of the examples, it puts them in a separate file, and then it does from sage all import star, and then it has all these examples. And then it just runs Python standard doc test on that. So I do use Python's doc test system, but I do some pre-parsing first. So, and this was really a huge problem for a long time because I was using just Python standard doc test, and you'd have to, for example, here you'd have to say from, you know, Sage rings, integer ring, import matrix space. It just got so ridiculously out of hand to write the examples. Plus, the examples wouldn't work if you just pasted them into the shell in some cases. It was ridiculous. Now the examples, if you're going to write them, they're exactly the same as what you type into the shell and put whatever the output is. So those are the two issues.
Right. And you don't have to worry about them.
So that's another thing. And it's really, really important to have these examples there because for matrices, if you look at the top here, if you look at matrices, the way it works is that you have a base class matrix, and that implements generic functionality for lots of different things, like getting an entry, adding a multiple of one row to another row, adding a multiple of a column. It implements it in a completely generic way, which will work over any ring but can potentially be slow. Then what I do is I derive from this class and make an implementation for a given base ring that's potentially, you know, blindingly fast in comparison to this and implement it in a compiled language. However, it's good to have all these examples so that you can test that things still work. And it's especially important. I mean, if you're going to re-implement a bunch of basic functionality, it's nice to just rerun the test and see that you haven't broken things, because you easily could if you're not really careful. The examples are a lot better in this file because this undergrad at UCSD who I hired went through the file and made a ton of examples for that file, but the other file doesn't have nearly enough examples. So the asymptotically fast linear algebra, if you want to read more about that, I talked about it in my graduate course last week, and I wrote up a bunch of notes and a chapter about it, and there's a bunch on the website for that course. And those algorithms, I'm trying to implement some of them, but there's so many, and there are so many different things that it's pretty hard to do everything. There's also just, there's some clever algorithms that I don't know if, I mean, they've been implemented sort of as tests of concepts, or as a test of concept in C libraries, but it's really hard to actually use them on a regular basis. Stick them in Sage, and then they just become transparently there. So I know some algorithms like that. Yeah, so hopefully that answers your question. But just also just this general structure where you make objects and you make things in them, that pervades all of Sage. You have matrix spaces, but you also have a lot of other things like that. Just a bunch of examples because I'm out of time. So, all right, so. So we're done for today, but I hope some people will come to me with some ideas about what they want to talk about next week. So we should have two talks next week, I think. And I don't know who's still busy with finals or the end of the quarter, but please come and talk to me if you can speak next week about something. Okay, so and I'll be around for a while, at least for the next half hour. So, thank you. And I'll put all these slides on the website.
So a really cool thing that I thought about was to be able to have a little widget on the calculator.
Yes.
That will send text to be autocompleted.
Okay.
So what is like a help window. Mm-hmm. So you have an input. And looking at different keystrokes and just populating the space while they take. Or we can just wait for them.
I think that would be better because it could be really slow. But every time you hit a key, it starts putting completions up here.
Yeah.
But just put in any click on the completion that you want.
Right.
And
or you would, or oh yeah, you can pop up documentation to this too.
Yes, I see. So you could.
And that could be in the page.
So it could just be the. Let's see.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's two things, documentation and the completions. So I like that idea. So you just have a box at the top or somewhere. I mean, it can't be at the top.
It can be on the top or the bottom.
You have to be on the sort of the top of the screen in a frame or something, a key like that. Because if it's at the top, and it could be using this, and you're way down here, it doesn't help if...
Yeah, that's true.
Like an example would be here. So Eshel, I want the completions of this.
Right.
So what do I do? I can imagine there's a little button here, or I hit Shift Tab. I don't know, some keystroke.
You can create like a drop down menu, can't you?
Kind of like what an IDE would be like.
Yeah.
Yeah. But how do you spell?
Like an IntelliSense can. Yeah. And you can trap. Yeah. You can trap the tab, right? Because I know.
Yeah. Definitely, you can trap the tab.
Right.
I'm not sure if tab is the right thing. It might be Shift. Oh. Like tab is nice because it allows you to skip between boxes, and Shift tab back.
Right. You can
so maybe
whatever
Control tab or.
Yeah. Whatever comes.
Control tab is another is the next tab, but. Yeah, there should be some. There's probably some. Maybe
you can make it like to the user.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to.
So yeah. I want to ask you, the guy that raised that question, he left before I could talk to him. Do you know who that is?
Yeah, Robert Bradshaw.
Okay, so you're just seeing like in your class.
He's in my class.
Okay, can you CC me on email to him so that I get his email? Like,
yeah,
that's
should be with
like what he needs to do.
Because
I mean, that's great. Like,
And he has a specific number that got factored using a distributed computation. And
oh, really?
Yeah, but it would be nice to be able to repeat the factorization of that number.
That's
like a 450-bit number that was really relevant to a recent finding of the largest rank elliptic curve over Q.
How did he factor that?
The guy ran, the guy had a cluster and he ran, I guess, 100 or so processes all at once trying to factor the number. And one of them succeeded and then killed everything.
Ah, I see.
And I think he maybe, I don't know if he tried different parameters on the 100, but it's a good example where you want to kill everything once one of them succeeds. You don't want to hold them to completion.
Yeah. Otherwise, that'll take a long time.
Sorry. See you later.
See you, Tom. Okay.
Hey.
So yesterday I dove in when I'm taking.
You should give a talk next week about how to create an Ubuntu package.
I'll do that short sort of talk.
You can give like a 20-minute talk, which is how to create an Ubuntu package.
Okay. I hope I'll.
Can you learn that in the next week?
I think maybe
not an entire Sage thing because that's.
You should
have some issues.
Oh yeah, well I can talk about difficulties with Sage.
Why did Ubuntu packages? There's this really cool tool called check install that you can use, and like they'll like make it really easy. So maybe you want to give that a try.
Check install.
Yeah. It actually can create like packages for a bunch of formats.
Oh, that's even better.
RPMs too.
Wow. Definitely looking down.
I cracked into the Debian developer, like developer newbie guide. It's kind of funny. It's pretty condescending.
Oh god.
It's like, are you sure you're prepared for this? This is a huge responsibility.
Grow up, young man.
First, you must kneel for one day at the altar.
That's the Debian spirit.
What should the interface be like for completions and help? I mean, I don't know any website that pops up a list box. Do you know of any that do that? Like, what does it even look like?
Yeah, like, there's the new, like,
what does that?
The new Google Complete or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's just a list of textings that you scroll down.
But that's like in the. Oh, like in Google, on the website?
It's Google,
or?
It's something that Google suggests.
Yeah.
Google suggests.
I've actually used
Google
it. It's Ajax, and it's...
Okay, so it's a...
Google suggests.
Right here.
Yeah.
Okay. So right here, so I say... I see. Oh, okay.
Factor or something.
I see. So you have a drop-down box.
So like that would be perfect.
But it'd be annoying to like always be trying to do it for you, but if you did some kind of key thing.
Yeah, it definitely would drive me crazy.
Yeah,
to
drive
me
crazy.
Yeah.
Actually, the new Firefox beta has that for the little top right bar thing.
Yeah.
The change log has suggest built into that.
Oh, wow.
Firefox 2 alpha.
It's I have it as a plugin.
Yeah.
But see, it does it up there because it's a plugin.
So
but it's a little different.
You can see what we do something like that. Have you also thought about working on the Google Juice, like getting up to your
the Google Juice? It's really hard on Sage for the word Sage. So you have to do trickery.
Yeah.
If you want to investigate trickery from proving Google rankings,
Google bomb.
Google bomb Sage.
I'm not quite sure how to do that, but it would be nice, actually, because sage is horribly low rank because it's such a common word.
Right.
Like sage fly fishing, sage publication, sage colleges.
It would be really nice.
Sage.com, sage.edu.
It's
the
third page or something.
Yeah, it's the very top thing on the third page, I think. Or the second to the top thing on the third page. So it might be tricky to move it up because there's so many competitors, but I wouldn't mind doing so.
It has to get at least second page. I know.
If you didn't say eighth, if you say Sage Algebra, it's the top hit.
Right.
And like Sage anything like relevant is the top hit.
Right.
But then it gets bad. You get down to Daniel Sage or something.
But like computer algebra, like open source computer algebra. Just random people aren't going to be searching Sage Algebra, but random people.
Free
algebra you want system.
That free would open really source computer algebra system. I mean, you're going to get things like Maxima, probably. I don't know.
Yep.
Oh,
yeah.
You get Maxima.
Sage? There's Sage. Look.
No, where?
It's in Wikipedia.
Look, my article in Wikipedia that I wrote.
That's a poor thing. Okay.
That's why Wikipedia is useful.
Yeah,
indexed. Wow.
Wikipedia.
Wow, look at that.
That's not bad.
That is pretty sweet. And there's a link on Wikipedia right there.
There. Okay, good.
Oh, my God. Okay. Damn, that's Wikipedia useful. Really works to get your name out. It's messed up.
Is there a link to this? All right, here's the Sage website.
Also, you just can have people blog about it. They'll always get it up.
Yeah, that's not happening. This is David. Should be David Joyner.
Wait.
Oh, no, this is... Yeah, this is David Joyner's website, which is a listing which has Sage on it.
Wait, he should have it. Isn't he like a maid?
Yeah.
Shouldn't he have it in like big letters at the top? If
yeah, he should change it. We should have him change that.
That's pretty good enough.
All right, I'll see you later. Bro.
Yeah, see you later.
See ya.
Yeah, I like the drop. I like the like, pop-down thing idea.
Yeah.
I wonder how that works.
I read about it. It's just like Ajax.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds good. So you just have it. You click something, and it completes. And then with help, how would that work? That would be a pop-up.
You can always have a sidebar. Like a sidebar and then the main programming.
Oh, yeah.
You can have like links, sidebar, and the sidebars can also do some Ajax-y pop-out stuff. Tom and I were talking about it for a second.
Okay. Wow. Intense.
So you can have tons of like little sidebar help, examples, links, real subtle bit.
Relevant stuff.
Relevant stuff.
Yeah. Okay, so do you want to talk next week?
Okay, sure.
Can you send me a title question?
Okay.
Maybe spend a few days first.
Yeah, I'll try to do it by Sunday night.
Okay.
I can mess around with a little bit tomorrow.
And you could talk. You could give pictures of elementary or your pictures of number theory.
Yeah. Well, I'll work on that more and more.
Okay. So give a talk. So you two will give talks that are each about 10 to 25 minutes next Thursday.
Cool.
Okay.
But I can't. I still have no idea how it's going to go. So if it doesn't go very well, at least I'll talk about my frustrations.
Just you can talk about it. Yeah.
So
that would be interesting as well. I mean, what is the secret behind creating packages for Linux distributions?
Yeah.
What's the name of that program you mentioned again? Check something.
Checklist. Check. No, not checklist.
No.
Check.
I don't know. Debian check. Check install, maybe.
Check install,
I think it's check install. That is a really clever thing Google suggests.
Yeah, it is.
Because if I said Debian check, I might not have got it, but it immediately tells me that's what I want to do is check install. That's really cool.
It's from Google there. If you Google something, and then you get to the Google page, and then you try it again from that page, they have it as default.
Oh, really?